someone join the line?
Oh, that was you, Deisha?
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
You gonna be, yeah, keep the mute.
You on the line?
Ken Mayer? Hello?
Hi. Thanks for calling, Dr. Mayer. Hi, this is Josephine. How are you?
I'm just fine, thanks. I didn't get in at first, but so far so good. So it's not the, for some reason, I guess I don't have the right version of Adobe. I'm not connecting with the slides. But I guess if worse comes to worse, I can just advance my own slides, right? And I can just tell you next slide, you know.
Yeah, that's fine. And I'll send you an email now with the login information.
Okay, because I tried to... I'm sorry?
Does it say you have to update your add-ons?
Yeah, and it says Adobe Connect add-on is not installed, so it may be installing it. It just, you know, but it's one of those things that's going around in circles for a while.
Okay,
it may take a while.
I think there's about maybe four slides before we introduce you. Maybe less than that, actually, about two slides. So we'll just let you know when we're ready for you to get started, and you can say next slide.
Yeah, I think that's, if worse comes to worse, I'll open that file and while waiting for the Adobe to see if that happens. But would you, if I do get on, would you be advancing, or would I?
It would be me. If you like, we can give you privileges so you can advance it yourself as well.
Okay. Well, we'll see if I can get if it opens up or not. But I've just in case, as Plan B, I've opened it, so I can definitely we'll see the slides.
Okay, that sounds good. So we'll probably wait about 5 minutes in and see how many people are on the line.
Sure.
We're expecting about 24 or 25 people. I would say the latest we'll start is 10 minutes after the hour because we're trying to keep it to about an hour.
Uh-huh. That sounds good. Yeah,
all right, so we'll
have me on yet.
Okay, great. So I'm going to put my phone on mute. Josephine, if you're there, this is Ken. It's installed now, so I'm all set. So if you want to turn over to me to click down, I think I can then. Okay, great. Thanks. So we just put you in presenter mode. We're just making a small change with the slides to see if the logos can show up. So we're switching it from a PowerPoint to a PDF. But you should be able to press the arrows on the bottom left-hand corner to change the slides.
Oh, great.
You want to test that? Really quick?
Yep.
Okay.
You saw me go back and forth?
Yeah, I think that's fine.
Great. Okay.
Okay, great.
I'll mute till you introduce me, and we'll be all set.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And hi, everyone on the call. We're going to get started in a few minutes. If you aren't already, please log into the webinar. And you can press *6 to mute your phone lines.
Sheila Wilson.
Good morning, Sheila. How are you?
Oh, I am grand, and yes, I'm
good, thank you.
Hi, it's Fred Smith.
Hi, Fred. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi, this is Wanda Allen.
Good morning, Wanda.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
It's good.
Okay, so we're going to wait a few more minutes for folks to call in and join the webinar. So in the meantime, if you want to mute your lines, you can press *6. We'll give it about 5 more minutes and see how many people are on the call at that point.
Okay.
Hi, this is Dorothy from Dallas.
Hi, Dorothy. Thanks for joining us. We're just waiting a couple more minutes before we get started.
Okay.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Louis Cruz.
Hi, is it Chris?
It's Louis Cruz.
Oh, Louis. Hi. We're going to get started in just one moment. Thank you for calling in.
Mark Lena.
Good morning, everyone. This is Njideka. I see a lot of people on the call, or at least 13 on the call. I'm sure that people will continue to come on as time goes on, but we wanted to make sure that we were respectful of your time. My name is Njideka. I am the coordinator of the Black Treatment Advocates Network, specifically the local network. So for those of you that are a part of the local networks, Atlanta, Chicago, Philly, Houston, Jackson, the Bay Area, in Louisiana, specifically Baton Rouge and New Orleans, in South Florida, L.A., you all are certainly more familiar with me as Josephine is the coordinator of the national network. I want to make sure that folks from BAI also kind of people on the call. I see Denise is on the call. You want to say hello? No. Denise is the coordinator.
Hello, I'm here.
So Denise is the coordinator of AHU, I believe. I'm not sure if Ronnie is on. Ronnie is the director of training and capacity building, of the training and capacity building department, and obviously Josephine is on the call. Josephine.
Hi, everybody.
And Josephine is the coordinator of the national network, and I know a lot of you have been in contact with Josephine. And so we wanted to make sure that we get this going. So thank you for being a part of the first Brown Bag Lunch webinar. Hopefully everybody has logged into the webinar, and we're going to be muting everyone for the most part and going through today's session. We're very pleased to have Dr. Ken Mayer on the call, that's going to be leading the majority and facilitating the majority of this webinar. And so I'm really just going to play more of a facilitation role. And so just so that we can kind of get it going. Hi, Marcia. Go ahead and put yourself on mute. *6 is to mute. Or however it is on your personal phone. So we're going to get started. First thing we want to start with is an icebreaker. So I see quite a few folks. Josephine, if you can probably help me out with some of the people that are listed on here in terms of who's represented. If you can just kind of type in the chat box where you all, what cities you all are from, just so Dr. Mayer knows who's represented. I see Tony, I know Tony's from the Bay Area, in California, Chicago, Philadelphia, State College, St. Louis, so all over the country. I don't know if this is the Marcia from Baton Rouge, New York.
This is Marcia from Texas, and I'm going to mute again. I'm sorry. I've got to get back to my laptop.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead. I see Wanda. I think Wanda's from Chicago. Boston, never mind. No, Cambridge, Massachusetts, at Oakland. So folks from across the country. And as folks go on, they can just put where they're from in there just so that we know. So in terms of this Brown Bag Lunch, we are very happy to be in collaboration with the Black AIDS Institute. Is very happy to be in collaboration with HPTN, the HIV Prevention Trials Network, with Fenway Health, and also with FHI 360. So we're going to get it going. The first thing we want to actually start with is an icebreaker. We're obviously going to be talking about biomedical and behavioral interventions. Everybody that's anybody in the HIV workforce needs to understand this. There are a lot of advancements, a lot of new developments that are coming down the pipe. regarding biomedical and behavioral interventions. And we really, you know, made sure that we put them together because we really don't feel like they have to be. Phil always says you can't have one without the other. They have to be, you know, together. People aren't going to take anything if they don't make behavioral changes to do it. And so one of the first things I want to do is I'm actually going to put a poll out for you. And I want to hear from you is, what are some of the things that you find interesting and or confusing about biomedical and behavioral interventions? So I'm going to go ahead and put that up. Tell me, do you guys see that yet? There you go. You should see it now. So what do you find interesting and or confusing about biomedical and behavioral interventions? So I see it's a new way to be more effective in the community. So I see the resistance of some HIV prevention. There's resistance from some people in HIV prevention to embrace biomedical interventions. Definitely have seen that. I'm interested in the ability for women to control HIV prevention. There's questions about when a person should take PrEP. So we're going to definitely talk about this, talking about the HIV prevention toolkit. So I see a couple of things. Just the idea of functionally cured, particularly given the newborn that folks were, or the baby that people that came out of Mississippi, a lot of the news that's been going on around that. So I'm going to broadcast these really quickly just so that you can see some of the things that people have been saying. Again, resistance to the ability for women to control HIV prevention, the idea of functionally cured, the idea of the different things that are in the HIV prevention toolbox, more culturally relevant interventions as well. So thank you very much. And if folks can also tell me something else I'm interested in and or we're interested in before we get started is, what do you want to learn? And so I'm going to put that poll up. I want to know what you want to learn, what you hope to get out of this this webinar. So feel free to start going. So, says I've noticed a push. A push for biomedical over behavioral. How can we advocate for more evaluated, homegrown, or Debbie interventions for our communities? So more info on prevention besides condoms. So that's what folks are interested in learning about. Anything else? How feasible is PrEP in real life? I know a lot of folks have questions about that. And how to best balance biomedical and behavioral. That'll be a great, great topic, or a great, great thing for us to go over. Let's see. How to enhance the quality, again, of homegrown interventions, and how to develop more community interventions in collaboration with biomedical. So some great, great things that people want to learn. So hopefully we're going to be able to touch on some of those topics. If we don't, make sure that we ask and we can definitely have a discussion about it. And so as we move forward, first I want to make note of our awesome facilitator for this particular webinar, Dr. Kenneth Mayer. Dr. Mayer has a lot of accolades. He is currently the medical research director and co-chair of the Fenway Institute. He's a professor of medicine at Harvard. and so many. You can definitely read all of his accolades. He's adjunct professor at Brown University, has affiliations with the American Foundation for Health, for AIDS research as well. But he's also the chair of the National Scientific Review Committee of the HPTN. He's part of the executive committee, and he's also national chair of the MSM Working Group for the executive committee of HPTN. And his areas of research include international HIV/AIDS, gay and bisexual men's health, HIV and AIDS prevention, microbicides, PrEP, PEP, vaccines, and much, much more that could not fit on this slide. And so you can see why he, while we, you know, really wanted to make sure that we had a leader in this field. And so we're very excited to have Dr. Mayer on this call. And right before I transfer over to Dr. Mayer, I just want to go over the learning objectives. By the end of this webinar, we want you all to be able to understand the use, effect, and current research status of microbicides, PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis, PEP, or post-exposure prophylaxis, vaccines, and treatment as prevention. We want you all to be able to identify methods of integrating biomedical interventions with behavioral programs. We also want you to be able to learn the benefit of combination prevention, and a lot of organizations are really talking about, again, the combination, as is the Black AIDS Institute. And also, we want you all to be able to increase the ability of you to implement and monitor capacity-building events that teach methods of integrated behavioral and biomedical interventions. And so without further ado, I want to hand it over to Dr. Ken Mayer.
Thank you very much, Jaika, and Josephine as well. Thank you for the Black AIDS Institute for the invitation to talk to you all today. And I want to thank specifically Georgette King from FHI 360 who helped arrange this. I'm really delighted to be able to talk some about what are some of the new developments. And the focus is going to be on what are the data, but I can see from your questions there are a lot of other topics that I may not cover in the slides, but I would welcome our discussion afterwards. So the first slide is just looking at the HIV prevention toolbox, and we're really at a point now where we have a number of different tools in different settings, and the evidence base differs for some of these. So, for example, male circumcision, there are three trials conducted in Africa showing that circumcision for adult males decreases their risk of becoming HIV infected by 50%. Unfortunately, not a benefit for women, and we can talk about the biology of that. But certainly, over time, that can certainly decrease HIV transmission in communities. We still think counseling and testing is extremely important because for a lot of these interventions, you really need to know if somebody's infected or not. So we'll talk a little bit about treatment for prevention and some of the exciting data over the past few years, but clearly, people need to know that they're infected before they would even consider starting antiretroviral treatment. And then another big focus of the HIV Prevention Trials Network and other research is the whole area of using antiretrovirals for HIV-uninfected people. So this is broadly called PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, using medication before exposure to HIV. And the topic of microbicides, people sometimes differentiate and think of microbicides as topical, but by the end of the talk today, you'll see that really microbicides are just a different way of delivering some of the same medications to protect people against HIV. There are long-time evidence-based other preventions that are very important. Clearly, condoms do protect, but they're not 100%, but if consistently used, they're highly protective. Harm reduction, including needle exchange, is extremely important for people who are sharing needles. There are evidence-based behavioral interventions, and I heard mention of the Debbies, and certainly there are some that have had benefit. The reason why we're talking about this whole issue, though, of positive prevention, treatment as prevention, and the use of antivirals is that the vaccines, there's been a glimmer with one study in Thailand on the horizon, but not yet at a level of efficacy that would suggest that we have a vaccine available tomorrow, whereas the antiviral drugs are something we have available today, so they may be something that we can use in the short term while waiting for a vaccine. But how do we do it right, and how do we match the appropriate behaviors and the appropriate cultural sensitivity is clearly a big issue. And towards the end of the talk, we'll talk a little bit about cash incentives because there's actually a whole school of research that says that sometimes incentives may motivate people to modify behaviors that are hard to change over time. So let's first talk a little bit about PrEP. So we know that the epidemic is continuing to grow worldwide. And here in the U.S., the epidemic is, unfortunately, there in the area of 50,000 new infections a year. That has not changed in recent years despite these promising developments. And we also know that there's increased health disparities in the epidemic, that particularly the African-American black communities here in the U.S. are most heavily impacted by this epidemic, black men who have sex with men and women at risk for HIV, and also heterosexual men as well. In terms of prevention, the two approaches, so PrEP, I'm talking about PrEP broadly, either oral medication or topical, and people are even starting to think about injectable medications, and then TASP is treatment as prevention. That's the abbreviation for that. So clearly there are ways to protect oneself against HIV, and for some people these are totally appropriate. So we don't think that everybody who has any risk should be on PrEP or should be on treatment. So certainly abstinence works if one is motivated. Monogamy works if one is motivated. Condom use is highly protective, but again, not 100%. Circumcision, again, just for males. So we clearly need new approaches to prevention. So PrEP is the idea of using the medications beforehand. And based on trials in the past few years, and I'll just summarize those in the next couple slides, last year the Food and Drug Administration approved the use of one specific combination antiretroviral medication, tenofovir, emtricitabine, or FTC is the other name for emtricitabine. The trade name is Truvada, to be used for the prevention of HIV transmission. And the idea is that this should be part of a risk reduction package. So the interest in PrEP is based on a number of data sources. There are animal studies that show that animals that receive medication beforehand are protected against HIV. We know that, for example, for mother-to-child transmission, PMTCT, that if a woman comes in labor and does not have prior diagnosed HIV infection and takes even a single dose of nevirapine, that the baby has a relatively increased protection against becoming HIV infected. And if you take a single dose of nevirapine at the time of delivery, that's not enough time for the drug to inhibit the viral load in the mother. So it's really the drug being available in the genital secretions and in the blood that protects the baby against HIV and getting into the fetal circulation. We also know that post-exposure prophylaxis, at least for healthcare workers, there's been a retrospective study that suggested that that was beneficial. So one thing that's coming down the pike, and we'll talk a little bit about, is the question about whether PrEP could be used less frequently, because that would certainly save costs and potential toxicities. But the data we have so far is only right now on daily PrEP use for the oral medication. So why this particular medication? It's the one that's been most studied for this. Of the antiretroviral drugs, it has limited side effects. Doesn't mean that it doesn't have any. So, for example, tenofovir can affect the kidneys. And so before we would start anybody on PrEP, we'd want to know that their renal function, their kidney function, is normal. But it does have a strong safety profile. It lasts in the body for a long period of time, so that there may be a forgiveness factor if one dose occasionally is missed. It's less likely to promote drug resistance than some of the older medications, and most importantly, there's proof of concept, but it doesn't mean that this is the only medication that will be used as PrEP. I think it's important to think of PrEP and this whole approach as early days, just like in 1996 was when the first time that HART, highly active antiretroviral therapy, was shown to work, and it took a good part of a decade to get currently better-tolerated single-pill-a-day kinds of regimens. I think PrEP is going to undergo evolution as well, but at least we have initial proof of concept. And here are the studies that have summarized the different PrEP results. So the IPREC study, which enrolled men who have sex with men in several countries, mainly in Peru, in Ecuador, in Brazil, in Thailand, and South Africa, and then at two sites in the U.S., in Boston and in San Francisco, the men and transgender women who were participating in this study were agreed to take a pill on a daily basis, and it was either tenofovir FTC, abbreviated TDF FTC, or a placebo pill, and the risk of becoming HIV infected decreased about 44% in the trial. And studies that went back and looked at what was the predictive value of people who were actually taking the medication, We found that on average, people were only about half the people were taking the medication. But of those people who were consistently taking the medication, the protective effect was 92%, and even in some sets of people, there was higher levels of protection. Now, we have to be careful about the 92% or even some of the data with 99%, because that was not a prospective study. That was a retrospective analysis. But it strongly confirms, and other studies did similar kinds of analyses, that you have a high level of protection if you're consistently taking the medication. There was a study done with young heterosexual adults in Botswana. Almost half of the population were women, a country where there's high HIV prevalence, so any new partner is associated with high risk of HIV exposure. This looked again at tenofovir FTC. Protective level was 62%. And then a study, a very large study done in Kenya and Uganda, where one partner was HIV infected, the other HIV uninfected, and it looked both at tenofovir alone versus tenofovir FTC, the combination medication, and found very high levels of protection, 67 to 75%, and again, close to 90% protection if drug was detected in the blood. So that all looks good. But then there have been two studies that were disappointments. One study enrolling women in Kenya, South Africa, and Tanzania, another enrolling women in South Africa, Uganda, and Zimbabwe, all countries where any new partner is associated with high risk of HIV. The women were not enrolled as parts of couples, and these studies did not show efficacy. But in both studies, when they went back and looked at adherence was between 23 and 33% between the two studies. The VOICE study actually looked at three different experimental conditions. Women were either assigned to receive a gel or a placebo, a gel or a pill, and the pill could be a placebo pill, tenofovir itself, tenofovir FTC. The gel would be active gel or placebo gel, and none of the conditions worked. But if you go backwards and say, what's the theme across these multiple different studies where some were successful, some were not successful, it's the correlate of having drug detected in the blood. So the take-home from these is that PrEP can work, and it certainly there are two studies that show that PrEP can work for women, but PrEP is not going to work if one is not adherent. So we have to figure out, like, how much, you know, what kind of forgiveness is there? But unfortunately, for example, in the VOICE study, when they looked at women who would come in every month and then took blood samples, they found that that about half the women weren't taking the medication at any point in time that they were coming into the study. There was never a detectable drug in the blood. So there's another take-home here, which is that you can have scientific proof of concept that antiviral medication can be protective against HIV, but if it's not either culturally acceptable or if there are other reasons why participants may not want to use the medication, then it's not going to be beneficial. And so the teams who've done these studies are now going back and interviewing participants and saying, well, you know, what really happened for you in the trial? And there's some preliminary data, and not hard to guess that these studies did compensate participants. There were institutional review boards, ethics reviews, so people were not paid high sums of money. They were paid for their time, for transportation, but those incentives may be enough for somebody to want to be in a study, but not necessarily trust the medication or feel that the medication is appropriate for them. They also found preliminarily that some of the women, even though they were in areas of high risk, and to enter the study, they were signing an informed consent that said, I recognize them at some risk, didn't really believe that they were particularly high risk because they weren't having lots of partners. They maybe just had one partner. And, you know, it gets back to the issue of knowing your partner status. And if in certain cultures knowing partner status is not common, then individuals may not feel they're at high risk, so not feel that they need to take the medication. So it really is causing a rethink as to how we do these kinds of studies to make sure that the products we're studying are of interest to the populations who can benefit the most. So the take-home from the different studies are that PrEP is not something to be offering everybody. So it really means that clinicians, because this is a biomedical intervention, clinicians have to learn how to talk to people to help them truly assess their risks. For some individuals, that may be fairly easy. They may be having multiple partners. They may be having STDs. But other individuals may not have lots of partners. So then it's a matter of knowing something about their partners to know if they're at risk. Certainly there are pros and cons of any medicine, and certainly PrEP is not a standalone intervention. It really should be part of a package of services. And very importantly, individuals should be HIV uninfected who are offered PrEP, so knowing people's status before starting medication, because the treatment for HIV is 3 antiviral medications, and the treatment for PrEP is 1 or 2 in these studies. So we certainly don't want to be giving people suboptimal treatment if they're HIV infected. So I want to update you on some other PrEP.
This is Tammy Kenny on the line.
I want to update you on some other work that's going on that's very important and relevant, I think, to the community's interests. The IPREC study did enroll men who have sex with men from diverse backgrounds, but given the gravity of the epidemic among Black men who have sex with men, and given the recognition that cultural tailoring is really important, that there may be histories of medical mistrust, and also important to have people feel that their needs are being met, that they're not just being offered a pill. We had conducted a prior study in the HIV Prevention Trials Network called HPTN061, the Brother Study, which enrolled 1,500 Black men who have sex with men in 6 cities across the U.S. And we found that there were a lot of unmet social needs that individuals had. So HPTN073 is a study being led by Dr. Darrell Wheeler, who's Dean of Social Work at Loyola University in Chicago, and the protocol co-chair is Dr. Sheldon Fields, who's an associate professor in the nursing school at Florida International University. And HPTN073 is a demonstration project. It's going to enroll 225 participants in 3 cities in the U.S. It's looking at PrEP. It's focusing on Black men who have sex with men, but the men are also being offered comprehensive clinical care coordination, so really trying to do an assessment of the factors that might facilitate or impede their ability to adhere on a daily basis to a medication regimen. And the kinds of questions are going to be, is PrEP going to be something that Black men who have sex with men want to use? Also, there will be expanded safety studies here to make sure, for example, that the effects on the kidneys are not harmful for Black men who have sex with men. And then the question is it feasible? So this is a demonstration project. It's being done in community settings. So the idea of is this something that can be scaled up and rolled out in the real world? So these are the 3 geographic areas where the study is being done in the U.S. This is not the only demonstration project. There are demonstration projects going on throughout the country, including places like Washington, D.C., Miami, Los Angeles, San Francisco. There are demonstration projects getting underway in Jackson, Mississippi, and in Houston, Texas, and a variety of other sites. So this is one that's particularly focused on issues for Black men who have sex with men, but there will be other projects that will enroll men who have sex with men and women to get additional information about PrEP feasibility. But the other big question about PrEP, one of the major questions is, can we give PrEP less often? I mean, one argument about PrEP is that if it's a young person and they're taking PrEP for a short period of time, even if they're taking it on a daily basis, and they avoid becoming HIV infected, they're taking 2 medications in 1 pill, and they may take it for a month, a year, 2 years, but that's different than taking triple medication for the rest of their lives. So that's sort of the rationale. But wouldn't it even be more cost-effective if people could take it less often, if people, particularly if people are not having unprotected sex every day? So HPTN067 is called the ADAPT study, and this study is looking at open label, so everybody knows that they're getting tenofovir FDC, that they're getting Truvada, and this study is going to be looking at 3 different conditions, looking at people who are taking pills daily, people who are doing event-driven PrEP, meaning that they're instructed to take the pill before they know they're going to have sex and make sure they take a pill after sex, and this is based on animal data that says that this can be protective, and then time-driven. So this is if people think they're mainly at risk on a weekend, for example, they would take the pill on Friday and Monday, but there would be a booster pill. And people are being instructed not in any of these conditions not to take more than 2 tablets in a 24-hour period or 7 tablets a week. So we want to avoid people taking too much medication. So there's how it looks. It's enrolling men who have sex with men in Harlem, men who have sex with men in Bangkok, Thailand, and women in Cape Town, South Africa, to look at. It's not an efficacy trial. It won't show that one of these is more effective in protecting people against HIV. It's an acceptability study looking at, with these regimens, if you ask somebody to take these medicines daily, are they more likely to miss doses than somebody who's taking them around the time that they have risk? Can people gauge their risk, for example? So these are the kinds of questions that this study is looking at. So here you can see.
Dr. Mayer, if I can make a quick interjection. For all of the people on the line, could you please press *6 to mute your lines from the background noise? Thank you very much. Go ahead, Dr. Mayer.
Sure, thank you. So the main study questions are, you know, does taking this medication intermittently, you know, how do people do compared to taking it daily? And, you know, do people have the same level of drug coverage around the times that they're risky, and can they get away with taking fewer tablets, and do they report fewer side effects? So this is one of the next important steps about how do we get it right to roll out this approach. And as I mentioned, these are the 3 sites around the world where the study is underway. Based on these data, this may help inform a larger study of looking at intermittent PrEP. And there's other work going on in France, looking at intermittent PrEP as well. So hopefully we'll have more data on this in the next few years. The next study I want to mention is called NextPrep. And this study is asking the question, so we have proof of concept with tenofovir-based regimens that we can have some protection. Great. But tenofovir is a mainstay of treatment. I mentioned that it can be associated in some people with elevations of creatinine, a test of kidney function. We also saw not clinically significant, but we did see some evidence of bone density loss in the IPREC study. It was not clinically significant, but that was over a year and a half. So there are ongoing studies looking at expanded safety. We don't think this is a big problem, but certainly if somebody was taking this medication who's HIV uninfected for 20 years, would there be a problem? Well, we don't have 20-year data, but clearly we want to have other alternatives. There may be people who have kidney issues who can't go on tenofovir, for example. So NextPrep is looking at another medication as the backbone for a PrEP regimen. And this is looking at a medication called maraviroc. And maraviroc has been shown to be safe and very well tolerated in people living with HIV, but it's not used very much. It inhibits HIV from getting into cells, and it's not been found to be better than most of the mainstays. So it's a medication that's not widely used, but could theoretically be used for protection. And so this study is looking at 3 active medications, maraviroc itself, FTC, amtricitabine, and tenofovir. So it's a double-blinded study. It's not an efficacy study. It's one now where we're looking at unaware, the researchers are unaware, and the patients are unaware of what they're getting in terms of the medication. But everybody gets 3 pills, so they get either the active maraviroc or placebo maraviroc, the active FTC or placebo FTC, the active tenofovir or placebo tenofovir. So you have anyone might be getting 1 of 4 combinations. And what we're trying to see is, are maraviroc combinations safer and better tolerated than the tenofovir mtricitabine, tenofovir FTC combinations? And whichever combination we think is the best tolerated, that might be the basis for a future study that's expanded to show how effective that this combination is. So this is what it looks like. There's a sub-study also looking at the concentrations of the medications in different tissues to say, does the medicine get where you need it for protection? So we're basically asking this question, are these combinations safe for at-risk men who have sex with men, transgender women, and women who are born female at birth? And the study is being done at 12 cities across the United States, and these cities are participating in either the HIV Prevention Trials Network or the AIDS Clinical Trial Group Network. This is one of the posters for the recruitment. We have websites, and certainly if you're in one of the cities, you know of people who may be interested, please let them know about the study. It's actively enrolling, and so far people it's been well tolerated, and we've been very gratified by the community response. So I want to, before leaving the topic of primary prevention, of what do we have to offer people who are not HIV infected, that's new, I want to mention the topic of topical PrEP, microbicides, and other new drugs and delivery systems, because this is sort of the future of PrEP. What it turns out is that one of the first studies that showed that PrEP worked, it was a topical PrEP study. This was the CAPRISA study. This was a study that enrolled women in KwaZulu-Natal in the area of South Africa near Durban, and the women were asked to use a gel topically around the time that they had sex, before sex and after sex. And this study actually was quite successful. It showed that women who used the active gel were 39% less likely to be HIV infected than women who got placebo gel. But once again, it was adherence was the most important thing. Using self-report for, to determine adherence, if women said they were using 80% or less of the medication doses around the time that they had unprotected sex, they didn't really have a benefit. This was not statistically significant. But if the women said that they used the gel at least 80% of the time, the benefit was 54%. So that's the real number there. So once again, these approaches won't work if people aren't going to be adherent, but if they are adherent, they can get some protective benefit. So you have the CAPRISA study, which was a successful gel study. The VOICE study was an unsuccessful gel study. CAPRISA asked women to use the gel around the time of sex. VOICE asked the women to use gel every day. So it may be that using gel right around the time of intercourse may result in higher adherence, and it may be the time, exactly the time that you need to have the medication around. So what's going on now in terms of the gel issue for women is that there's a study, a tiebreaker study called the FACT study, and that is underway right now. That's enrolling women in South Africa. It has been fully enrolled. So if that study has the same result or a similar result to the CAPRISA study, that may lead to a path for licensure for gel for women in Africa and other parts of the world. The other question is, can you use this vaginal gel to protect people who have anal sex, men who have sex with men and women engaging in anal sex and or their partners? Well, there was a study of the vaginal gel inserting it rectally, but the vaginal gel contains something called glycerin, which helped the gel disperse well in the cervico-vaginal area, but was not well tolerated rectally. So they had to go back and do a reformulation, and this was a study called MTN-007, and this enrolled men and women at three cities in the United States, in Boston, Pittsburgh, and in Alabama, and it found that the new gel was very tolerated. So it may be that you may need to use one form of gel for vaginal sex and a different form of gel for anal sex, though ideally you would have one gel that could be used at either site. But this again speaks to that the field is still in early days. There's a new study going on that's called Project Gel that's focusing on men who have sex with men and male sex workers, including, which is an expanded safety study, and then a study MTN-017, which is going to look at expanded rectal gel, which is going to enroll men in the U.S., in Peru, in South Africa, and in Thailand. Then the other important thing, just looking down the pike, is the issue of using new antiretroviral medications for prevention. So there is this whole issue of adherence has been a big concern about taking pills. So people have actually looked at how can you reformulate these medicines and maybe put them into like a ring device. So there's a study of dapivirine, which is a non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase drug. And this is inside a ring that women can insert vaginally and has been studied in the U.S. in women and found to be safe and well-tolerated. And expanded safety and efficacy studies are now underway in Africa. There are two other compounds that are similar molecularly to dapivirine that are in earlier phases. I mentioned Miravrox, and people are also looking in early studies of Miravrox inside a ring. So the idea of the ring is that it might be able to be inserted once a month, be removed, and the initial safety study said that the women felt that it was they didn't feel it after insertion and that it was comfortable. And this is very similar. There are hormonal contraceptives that are offered this way. The other approach is also similar to some hormonal contraception. That's saying, can medication be injected in a way that the injection could be once a month or even quarterly? So there are two compounds. One is called rilpivirine, or has a technical name, TMC-278, and this is going to be undergoing further studies in the HPTN in the U.S. and in South Africa in the next few months, expanded safety studies. And then there's a newer product called GSK-744, which inhibits another stage of the HIV life cycle, and that's not yet in human studies but planned in the near future. So let's change gears, because I want to make sure we have time for some discussion, and let's talk about treatment as prevention. What's the background here? Well, the idea here is not just as treatment as treatment. I mean, the most important thing for treatment is to make it available to people living with HIV so they can benefit and not have HIV-related complications. But there's more data that says that people who start treatment early will be less likely to transmit to other people. And the most important study to that end was HPTN-052. This was a very ambitious study. It enrolled 1,763 discordant couples. So the couple, so both partners in the couple had to know about each other's status before coming into the study. The uninfected partner, this was study was already begun 10 years ago, so it was at a time where the guidance in virtually all countries around the world was to start treatment automatically at CD4 counts below 350. So these were individuals who had higher CD4 counts by the standard of that time, 350 to 550. And both couples were told about the study and told that the infected partner was being offered once in the study, was randomized to be offered treatment immediately or to be delayed. And if the person developed symptoms related to HIV, they'd start treatment earlier, or if their CD4 count fell to 250. The study had an independent safety monitoring board, including ethicists and community members who saw the data, how the participants were doing. And the ultimate outcome was, did the uninfected partners become infected, or did the people who were infected in the delayed arm, were there many bad outcomes that they had to stop the study? So what happened in the study was, science called it the breakthrough of the year, because there was so much good data that came from it. The study was conducted, a pilot part of the study was conducted in the U.S., but is primarily enrolling couples in several countries in Africa, South Africa, Zimbabwe, Malawi, and Kenya, and also enrolled participants in Brazil, and also Botswana in Africa, and also enrolled people in Brazil, India, and in Thailand. So the U.S. Public Health Service revised their guidelines, because what essentially happened was that virtually all the transmissions that occurred happened in individuals who were not on treatment. There were 11 transmissions that happened where the uninfected partner became infected, where the virus was genetically different. So this was meaning that the partner had an outside relationship. But of 28 infections that occurred within the couples, in 27 cases, the partner was not on treatment, and so no transmissions occurring in the partners who are on treatment. The one case that occurred in a partner on treatment, that partner had initiated antiretroviral treatment less than 3 months before the transmission occurred to the partner. And the treatment doesn't suppress the viral load overnight. It takes weeks to months. So by clinical trials rules, this was a failure of early treatment. But in reality, we now know to recommend to people to wait at least 3 months, maybe 6 months, if they're going to rely on this as a way to decrease transmission. So this study changed the U.S. Public Health Service guidelines to suggest that if a person is ready, treatment could begin independent of CD4 count because of these benefits. The other thing about it was that people did better as well. There was less tuberculosis among the people who started treatment earlier. Now, this study doesn't prove at very high CD4 counts, and there's some work still underway. A study called the START study is still underway to say, gee, if your CD4 count's 800, is it beneficial? But there are other people who feel that there are observational studies and there's some clinical data that there are benefits to early treatment. So what does this mean? So this means that we need to address barriers to expanding testing. There's still a lot of HIV stigma, so it's not something we can just say overnight, everybody just start treatment, because treatment is a lifelong commitment. And we have to make sure people know their status, people are linked to care and they engage in care, and people are willing to initiate and to adhere. So it's, you know, it's a great thing to do the clinical trial because that's the database we need to make decisions, but it's not enough to do the clinical trial. The implementation out in the community is really important. And this slide, many of you may have seen before. This is known as the continuum of care, or some people call it the cascade. And it basically says in the United States, we have almost 1.2 million people living with HIV, and more than 200,000 people at this point don't know their infection, or about 200,000 people. There's a drop-off in terms of people finding out they're infected and having a first clinic appointment, linkage to care, and then there's a big drop-off of people who are stably in care. So of the people who are in care, the majority, but not all, start treatment, but there's still a drop-off. Not everybody is virally suppressed. So if you do the math, it's only about 30% of people who are HIV infected right now are suppressed. So clearly there's a lot of important work to be done about figuring out how to identify people who aren't aware of their infections, how to arrange for people to get into care and to be stably maintained in care. So one of the studies that's trying to look at this is called TLC Plus or HP1065. It's looking at testing, linkage to care, plus treatment. This study is looking at, it's a feasibility study, so it's not going to be definitive, but it's comparing cities where there's the intervention to communities where people are evaluating business as usual, looking at surveillance. So the two intervention cities are Washington, D.C. and New York, and the other cities, Chicago, Houston, Miami, and Philadelphia, are being observed to see what's going on there, because it's not as if there aren't initiatives across the country to increase testing and linkage to care. So it's saying if you add a few other kinds of interventions, do they help? So the linkage to care piece is involving 37 HIV test sites, 18 in the Bronx in New York, 19 in Washington, D.C., and anybody who tests at these sites is found to be newly infected and confirmed to be positive after having been out of care for at least a year can get a coupon at the test site and then can get a gift card for getting lab work done and a gift card for meeting with a provider. And the idea is to see, does this kind of incentive get people stably established in care? So it'll be followed over time. There's another part of the study looking at viral suppression. So 20 sites in the Bronx and 19 in Washington, D.C. People will get gift cards in the program, and the individuals are eligible if they're on antiretroviral therapy, they have a stable relationship with the clinic, and they have a suppressed viral load. So some people, this is a highly controversial study because the idea of you're paying people to do things for their own health behaviors, but actually there are behavioral economists who have looked at other clinical issues like diabetes or smoking cessation and found that these modest incentives can mean a lot for people and can help them adhere to behaviors that will help their health. And in the long run, it's in the interest of our society to have fewer people who are not virally suppressed, for example, and to have fewer people out of care. So these are the kind of things that HP1065 can start to look at. So the study has other components, too. So it's not just the incentives. It's looking at social mobilization. So how do you do more messaging in the community to offer more testing, work with emergency rooms. It's also doing provider training. And it's also trying to train providers to offer more education to people who are infected about prevention. So there's a variety of different aspects that are being looked at here. So I just want to conclude, and I'm really looking forward to your questions and comments. This is sort of my view of the universe these days with these new approaches. The most important thing is to increase testing. People, serostatus awareness is really important. So everybody who hasn't been tested should be tested. Certainly the CDC recommendation is ages 13 to 64 at the very least. But people who have risks should be tested again. If people test negative, it doesn't mean that everybody should be offered PrEP. It means that the clinicians need to know how to do a risk assessment. If they start PrEP, adherence is important. If people test positive, certainly counseling about behavior is important, but even more important is to link to care, to enroll and be stably in care, and to adhere to medication. And what's very important is that we know that the reasons why people may engage in risky behavior, the reasons why people may not be in care, may be related to economic issues, may be related to depression, substance use, may relate to relationships. So if we don't get the individual behavioral and the social and structural issues right, we're not going to make good headway. So it's not one simple thing, but I think if we can improve on each of these areas, we can really have an impact in slowing down the rate of spread in the United States. Here are some additional resources for you to look at. I know I've covered a lot very quickly, and I apologize for that, but I thought it would be useful to have the full picture, and I really want to thank you so much for your participation. These studies are funded by your tax dollars and mine, by the National Institutes of Health, and I want to particularly thank Georgette King and Jonathan Lucas, who work with the HIV Prevention Trials Network in community engagement, for their help in putting this talk together. So thank you, and I look forward to your questions and comments.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Mayer, so much for all that. It was a lot of information, but hopefully some of it was a review. Some of it, there may have been details that folks didn't necessarily know about, but hopefully you definitely got something from that. What we want to do to kind of help this, help the question portion is, everyone at the top of your screen should have or should see a button of a little person that's raising their hand, and to the right of that image is a is an arrow pointing down. If you click that, there's different selections that come up. If you have a question, if you can use that to raise your hand, that would help us to then kind of throw it to people so that we can kind of give order to the question and answer portion. So I already see Nathaniel Johnson has raised his hand. So Nathaniel, if you can unmute your line by pressing star 6 and ask your question to Dr. Mayer.
Number one, I just want to say I really appreciated the information and some of it, and I've been in the game a long time and I still found some new information in this and I appreciate it. This is a lot of stuff to digest. Will we be able to have our own copy of this, because I tried to copy at least the cascade portion, because that is such a compelling graphic. When you talk about to people, of all the people who are infected and this reduced number who are virally suppressed, I'm the kind of person that thinks that if you present compelling information to people, many people can draw their own conclusions and begin to have some internal motivation to participate. I'm just want to confirm that will we be able to use some of this will this be included in the handouts that will be available to us? I started the conference a little bit late due to a conflict, but again, will this be part of the handouts that will be available to us, especially the cascade?
Yes.
Good.
Oh, I'm sorry.
From my standpoint, any of the original slides that I generated are absolutely would love for you to share them. So that'd be great.
Yes. Okay, so everyone will get an email immediately after, within the next hour to 2 hours after this is done. You will all get a PDF of the slides that were presented today, and then you'll also get a PowerPoint version so that you can use it during your own brown bag events.
Thank you.
No problem. The next person we're going to go to is Tammy. I believe Tammy has her hand raised. And Tammy, if you don't have audio, feel free to type in your question, if that helps. And while we're waiting for Tammy, because I see that her hand is raised, in the meantime, I do have one poll question that there's one question before I get to the poll. So Alan is asking, what is the likelihood of Truvada resistance HIV, and what impacts or risks will this have for individuals on PrEP?
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. So in the clinical trials, there was very little development of resistance. The people who became resistant were in the process of becoming HIV infected when they entered the trial. So for these studies, people had generally had to be tested with antibody tests twice, but they weren't all tested for HIV RNA for the actual virus. So when, you know, so if somebody had unprotected sex, you know, 3 days before screening for the study, they would be antibody negative, but they might already have the virus multiplying in their body. And when and in the beginning of HIV infection, there can be a lot of virus before the immune system kicks in. And so in that setting, you can select for resistance. So we know that resistance can happen, but fortunately, it was extremely uncommon in the studies. But the studies are not the real world. So the study, you know, in the studies, we saw every participant once a month. These were, you know, the participants had to be very altruistic to be in these studies because it was, you know, took time away from their schedules. And you know, for the early studies, they had a 50-50 chance of getting a placebo, and we hadn't proved that this approach worked. So it was definitely people who were willing to help advance the knowledge. So, you know, what we say in the studies are that shows efficacy. So that means proof of concept that this approach can work if people take the medication. But effectiveness is the real world. And I think so the take-homes to your question, which I think is a very important question, are that there can be a worst-case scenario where I think we can definitely predict that resistance can occur. So somebody who gets a prescription for tenofovir FDC, for Truvada, and then doesn't take it consistently but has a lot of risks, you know, engages in unprotected sex, and doesn't come back for regular follow-up, then over time a person could select for a resistant virus. So we definitely are concerned about that, which is why, you know, this is something that I think no clinician should push any patient to do, as much as I think we are trying to work with clinicians so that they're educated to help educate their patients who might benefit from this approach.
Great. All right. So I see some folks may be typing. What I want to do right now before we get to any further questions is I'm actually going to do a poll. We're going to make sure that people were listening. And I'm going to put a poll out. Just want you guys to answer it. There we go. There it is. So which of the options below is an accurate description of PrEP? Feel free to just quickly push a button. Again, just making sure that you all were listening. And Alan, we're going to get to your follow-up. So folks can just... respond. Only have a few. All righty. It's right about 12. So I did put in a trick question in there, and I think that some folks fell for it. So which of the options below is an accurate description of PrEP? So the first option says it's the use of HIV treatment medications to reduce the risk that an HIV-positive person will pass the virus to their sexual partner. And so we know. Sorry, Dorothy. So we know that PrEP is for HIV negative folks. And so the third one is the correct option. It should be delivered as part of a comprehensive package of prevention services. So it is given to HIV negative persons, but also in combination with other prevention services. So it was still a good response. Sorry, I had to do the trick question. I had to make sure you were listening, paying attention. So thank you for participating in that. And we wanted to, so Alan, I'm going to go to you, but we also want to kind of ask some questions. Actually, I'm going to ask one question, one scenario to Dr. Mary, if you can stay with us for a minute. I want to ask you a question that was posed. So I see Alan says, looking from the lens of a person that adheres to meds but may encounter a positive person that has gone off the meds. So thank you for that. So Dr. Mayer, I want to pose a question to you. So let's say you are speaking with a former CISTO or 3MV participant who states that they are still having challenges using condoms consistently with new partners. He or she also states that they tested HIV negative recently but was successfully treated for an STD. Would you include information about PrEP in that conversation? And if so, what keys might you raise during that conversation?
Yeah, I think that's a great scenario. So that this is an individual who has some risk, and so I think it's a good thing to have this as part of the conversation, but it's not the first thing. So you know, somebody could have a new STD because they're in a new relationship, and then so the question would be in that relationship, you know, where are things now, you know, as opposed to if somebody says, you know, this is somebody I met online, and I might continue to meet people online. That's somebody where I'm starting to think, well, this person might benefit from PrEP. So I think it's really going to be the context of the situation, you know. And again, if a person is in a new relationship, the first kinds of things you want to think about are, what do you know about your partner? Can you comfortably, find out your partner's status? There's been some really great work at Emory University on people testing together, both heterosexual and gay couples testing together. We know that in some settings there may be coercion or potential for violence. So it's not, again, wearing my clinical hat as opposed to the research hat, the clinical hat is really finding out more from the circumstances of that person's life. But, you know, if they're in a single partner setting, the first thing is to know more about the partner. If they're in a discordant couple, they're definitely a good candidate, and they don't want to use condoms, they're a good candidate for PrEP. If there's somebody who has partners with, multiple partners and not comfortable negotiating around safer sex or negotiating to know enough to be comfortable about serostatus, that's somebody where the PrEP conversation might want to begin.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Before, maybe I should just get back to Alan's question, too, and then have to take others. Because Alan was asking a really interesting scenario, too, which is what if I'm on PrEP and I have a partner who I know is infected, but I'm not sure the partner is adherent to his or her medication. And that again, is a setting where there definitely is a theoretical risk. In other words, people who are infected who are not adhering to their medicines, if their medicine contains tenofovir or FTC, you can develop resistance if you're not adherent to that. But it's not that common. So, again, it gets into knowing more about the individual, you know, and knowing more about the partner. But in that setting, PrEP might, it's certainly a theoretical risk. We fortunately haven't seen that yet, but it's really early days. But it definitely could be a real scenario. So that would be one where I'd really want to know more. I mean, the partner might not be on a Truvada tenofovir-containing regimen, so then it would be a moot point. But if they were on that kind of regimen, then again, it would be great to be able to do couples counseling with the clinician to know the person's viral load and to know whether they had resistance testing done recently, so to know whether PrEP would still work in that setting.
Okay. Thank you. So I have three questions, and I'm going to kind of go in the order that I received them. So I'm going to first go to Tammy. I'm then going to go to Deshaun, who I see whose hand is raised, and then I'm going to go to Marcia, who has typed her question in the box. So Tammy says, I work in a lot of rural counties. How do I get people to come in and get tested? And if Dr. Mayer or even other people can even kind of type in answers and responses to that, that would be helpful. But Dr. Mayer, if you have any suggestions around that?
You know, I think every, all over the country there are different communities that have more resources than others, and I think this is an important question. The best thing I could say would be that, that the HRSA and the CDC fund programs for provider training. So there's the AIDS Education and Training Centers, which are situated all across the U.S., so there's full coverage, and they all have websites. So so finding out where the local AIDS Education Training Center. Now, their focus has been on HIV-infected people, trying to train providers to provide optimal care for people living with HIV, but I know at least in New England, our AIDS Education Training Center also is trying to increase awareness about different kinds of prevention, and certainly they would be knowledgeable about where is the best testing site and which places might be most culturally competent. So I would rely on them as a local resource.
Thank you. Deshaun, I see you have your hand up. If you can go ahead and press star 6 or unmute your phone and then ask your question.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I was
just
muted,
Deshaun?
And unmuted myself.
Oh,
hello.
Okay.
Okay, yeah, I was okay. So I just had a question as far as I know that the topic is called the integration of biomedical interventions and behavioral interventions, and I know that thank you, Ken, for talking a lot about the biomedical interventions, and I just wanted to know when we presented how do we tie in the importance of the behavioral interventions that are ongoing with the biomedical interventions?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and it's always the press of time because I don't know. I know everybody's busy and how much time people have, but I think there's the first thing is that in each of these trials there was strong behavioral components built in that were part of the trial. So, because for example, adherence is very important, and so there's been work done by a researcher named Rave Amico, who's at the University of Connecticut, who's developed something called Next Step Counseling. And so she's starting to write up some of the lessons learned from trying to develop adherence interventions for MSM and IPREC. So that's part of the answer, is that if go back to the actual original studies, they're ways in which people thought to best counsel people about using the medication. But the idea of the Debbies was used earlier, was mentioned earlier, and actually there is a study that is underway now that will be looking at the combination of Debbies plus PrEP for young MSM. And that's a study of the Adolescent Trials Network that's getting underway. And one part of it will be enrolling MSM and transgender women who are between the ages of 18 and 22 years old, and there are about 14, 15 sites across the U.S. And if you go to, if you keyword search Adolescent Trials Network, you'll get to the homepage and can find the sites and see if there's sites near you. And then there's another study that hasn't gotten underway yet that will be a parallel study for 15 to 17-year-olds. And the studies are comparing two different Debbies, an individually based one and a group one. The group one is Many Men, Many Voices. So the idea there is to say, does the combination of a Debbie plus PrEP, is that helpful for young MSM and transgender women? The study is not going to be an efficacy trial, so it won't show definitive data, but again, it'll be checking drug levels. There'll be a lot of interviews with people and saying, did this work for you? Does this make sense? So that's sort of like, I think, the next generation also of prep studies is to say what behavioral things should we be building into the program. And I think a lot of CBOs, by working with some of the clinicians locally, might be able to develop home-adapted approaches that will be essentially some of the demonstration projects. And then the clinical care coordination in HB10073 that I mentioned, that's very much Dr. Wheeler is a social worker, and Dr. Fields is a nurse with has training in nursing and in health service delivery. So they're both very much focused on who are the individuals who might benefit from PrEP when they encounter public health systems. What are some of the behavioral supports that can be built in? So they're kind of in the process as they're developing the protocol and the training to try to use the best of what's already known about behavioral prevention.
Thank you, thank you. So we're going to try to get things wrapped up very soon. I know one of the things that really stood out for me that you said was, I mean, ultimately this really speaks to the importance of behavioral interventions and getting that part tied down, is that none of these approaches will work if people aren't adherent, and that really speaks to behavioral aspects of this. And people won't be adherent if people don't, whether it's understand the meds, let alone understanding, you know, HIV science. If people don't have access to healthcare, if people don't have stable, you know, primary needs met, like housing, food, transportation, you know, and other things, and so or have, you know, other types of things together, whether it's around substance abuse issues or other type of things that may need counseling. And so all of those things are really, really important with this entire discussion. And so I'm sure that as you all go on and you do your brown bag lunches, that those will be part of your discussions as well. Marcia, I'm going to Dr. Mayer, this is going to actually be the last question, just so that I don't go over it, and then we're going to wrap up the webinar immediately after. But just, she had a question about the Maraviroc. In one of your slides, you said that Maraviroc, I believe it's an oral and in ring form, and that it was a CCR5 inhibitor. So her question was, she just wanted to make sure that she heard correctly, and that would it only be effective with the CCR5 tropic HIV?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. So CCR5 is one of the two receptors that HIV needs to use to get inside of cells. So if you can sort of envision, like, the cell is a big sphere, and the virus is a little thing that's trying to get in from the outside, it's like a lock and key. So it the virus sort of sends out little feeler for the CD4, and then it has to find something else before it can fuse and get inside the cell. So by blocking CCR5, you're blocking the most common way that the virus can get into cells. But there is a second sort of way that some variants of the virus can get in a different kind of receptor called CXCR4. But the important thing to know is, the reason why it's a great question is that Maraviroc by itself, we don't think can 100% block every strain of HIV. That's part of why HPTN 069 Next Prep is looking at Maraviroc plus FTC, or Maraviroc even plus tenofovir. You know, so the question that the NIH and the HPTN will have to think about is if adding a second drug has more side effects, then is it better to, if you think that having few side effects with Maraviroc alone would be very highly, the adherence would be at a high level, then is that preferable to adding a second drug? On the other hand, if the side effect profile, say by adding FTC, is comparable to Maraviroc alone, then would it not be better to hedge one's bets and have two antiviral medications in one pill against HIV? So those are the kind of things. So Next Prep is an early study, but it's definitely not the last word on how we would use Maraviroc for prevention.
Thank you, Dr. Mayer. All right. So if folks can just, for one last time, just press mute. We're actually wrapping up now. The questions that are on the webinar slide, if you can just type in your responses. So we would like to know what types of event structures you're considering for your brown bag event on the 19th. So whether it's a town hall structure, a class, a workshop, report back to a small community or organizational group or something else, we'd love to hear how you were thinking about doing yours. You can just, again, go ahead and type it into the chat box. And also if you can just identify two local needs that you already see this topic addressing, even if it's only in part within communities where you are locally. So, again, as we kind of wrap up, so please, Josephine will be submitting or sending you all evaluations for this webinar within or by the end of today. So make sure that you fill those out. Please send her your organization's logo and email her your biography and picture as soon as possible. And also please send her your event information forms by this Friday just so that we can get you all flyers for the brown bag lunch or for your specific brown bag lunch events. As also, finally, upcoming training. So the next, our next national webinar is going to be on the Affordable Care Act. It's going to be on a Wednesday, May 15th. So please be sure to keep your eyes peeled for that because we'll be sending out information. The next brown bag lunch will be in June, and that's going to be confronting barriers to Black leadership in HIV/AIDS and education and advocacy. And then we're also, the one immediately following that will be July 2nd. And that's going to be on HIV and co-infections. We also encourage you to look into other Black AIDS Institute programming, AHU, our African American HIV University. This summer we're actually going to be launching a science and treatment college. So if you would like more information about that, please feel free to email us at programs@blackaids.org. You can also reach out to Josephine or myself regarding the Black Treatment Advocates Network, whether it's on the local level or the national network. Many of you know that this year we are going, if you don't know, this year we're going to be launching a new local network in Washington, D.C., so we're very, very excited about that. So if anybody is in that area and was interested in participating, again, please email programs@blackaids.org. We've also launched our knowledge, attitude, and behaviors survey of the HIV workforce. We know a lot of folks that are out, whether they're outreach workers, peer navigators, program coordinators, clinical coordinators, and we all are oftentimes the first responders are the first people that people with HIV or people that are high risk encounter. And so we need to make sure that we know what we're talking about and that we have the information. And so we're doing a national survey to assess where we are as the workforce so that we can kind of get a better idea of how to, whether it's retrain and improve, building the capacity of the workforce to respond to HIV. And finally, Beyond the Quo is a new initiative that the Black AIDS Institute is launching this year. It's for Black gay men, both positive and negative, that combines online engagement and ground-level advocacy. So if you are interested in any of those, again, feel free to email us at programs@blackaids.org. And are there any announcements from the group? Feel free to put them in the chat box. Again, I want to wrap up, but please, feel free to put them in the chat box if there are any announcements just across the country, things that people are doing. And we want to thank you for attending, appreciate you, and we will, again, you're going to be receiving an email from Josephine regarding some of the reminders about the evaluations, the next steps and things like that. Again, thank you so much, Dr. Mayer, for facilitating and providing some knowledge to us this morning. And without further ado.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Dr. Mayer. Thank you, everyone.
And take everyone, care, everybody. Please have a great, great day, and we will hear from you all very, very soon. Bye-bye.